in the horrible madness of war.
We need to stop bombing people's homes.
It's not anti-European.
Stop sending arms into conflict zones.
It's common sense.
Millions of Europeans struggle to feed their families and heat their homes.
All wars are evil and all victims deserve support. And until we get on that page, we have no credibility whatsoever.
When are you going to wake up and start living in the real world?
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome from sunny Brussels. Bon dia for Catalan listeners, which I'm sure there's many of you out there. We're here with our two favorite MEPs. I heard that you had a very busy weekend. I missed it, but maybe you can tell us some more about it.
Yeah, no, we were delighted. We had organized a peace activist forum here in Brussels. We had representatives from 11 countries. Mixed backgrounds in some ways. We had some very experienced anti-war activists from the likes of Britain, Ireland, Italy. Then we had some conscientious objectors, some civil society organisations that would be more of a pacifist background. But in any case, it was great. Good representatives across both East and West Europe against the backdrop of the war in Ukraine, of course. Focusing really on the common problems that we all have. We've all been subjected to the massive avalanche of war propaganda, worse probably in this war than any other, in that no alternative view is allowed breakthrough. But I think we all, there's a great bit of solace kind of in the fact that we're all in it together and that some of the experiences were quite similar from the different countries, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, it was great to meet people from different countries. And more or less the same wavelength, and the interaction between them was really important, and I think it's something that we should do more of, because you learn something new from everyone that you meet every day anyway, and interacting with people from 11 different countries was a great idea, and it worked very well. The previous night I was in Dublin talking on something, a theme somewhat similar. It was Irish neutrality, and it was part of the James Connolly Festival. And that also was very interesting. It was held in the New Theatre. And obviously Irish neutrality is also under threat at the moment from the political class and the Irish media. And I suppose the general theme of the night was that Ireland has traditionally been not very interested in being killed or killing others in wars that have really nothing to do with us. Most wars are of an imperialist nature of one form or another, and they're pretty stupid, and we really shouldn't be engaging in war. And neither should anyone else. And I think it's very important, given what's been happening in the last while, that the anti-war movement gathers a bit of pace and engages more with the people all across Europe and beyond.
Well, I mean, traditionally we haven't, but under little Micheál Martin, we're certainly, the Irish establishment are trying to change that anyway. They've been incredibly sort of talking up conflict with Russia, actually. And there does seem to be a very orchestrated campaign. This is an all-out assault now on our neutrality. He has these little forums, supposedly consultation forums, setting up, which aren't selected guest lists. We've asked to present at it, haven't heard a word back. No doubt we won't be asked to present at it. I know a lot of the groups are boycotting the events and are not participating because it's just a stitch-up anyway, which it is. But you see all the stuff in the media now about sort of Russian ships in Irish coastal waters, the cables under the sea being sort of suspected to be set up for a Russian attack. I mean, they've more interest in that now on a cable that has never been attacked than asking a question about Nord Stream, which was attacked. The biggest, sabotage on a piece of infrastructure, and no one in the Irish media wants to know anything about that. But yes, they're arbitrarily discussing a random sort of Russian cables in a nonsense to try and undermine our neutrality.
Yeah. I mean, people need to realise that war is a money racket, And it serves the interest of a few elites, and very often these elites actually control the media as well. So we have the media promoting a war, we have politicians promoting war, as in the case of Ukraine. But the politicians and the media promoting the war are either too old to enlist to fight in it, and their kids probably too well off to be fighting in it. So what you have is you have people of a well-off background who promote war and organise wars to start, but poor people end up doing the fighting and dying. It is just so stupid. But unfortunately, the media doesn't present it in those terms. But that's the truth.
Yeah, and that was an interesting point actually brought up at the weekend. We had representatives of conscientious objectors, and May the 15th was actually International Day for Conscientious Objection. So basically people who refuse to fight in war, who recognise, I suppose, that militarism is just there for the profiteers, but they're either pacifists or for moral reasons or religious reasons, people decide that they are refusing to fight in a war. That's a right that they have enshrined in international law, but that right has been violated clearly in the conflict in Ukraine as elsewhere. And very interestingly and tragically, we have hundreds potentially of conscientious objectors in prison in Russia at the moment, refusing to fight in the war there. But there are also people in prison in Ukraine, again, refusing to fight also. And next week, we have the first case that's going to the Supreme Court in Ukraine, a guy, Vitaly Alexeenko, who is in prison in a very difficult situation now in Ukraine. And I think a lot of anti-war and pacifist activists the world over will be rallying behind him next Thursday, hoping that he is released, and that sets an important precedent, because people have the right to refuse war. It's interesting that in Europe now, there's 18 countries still have conscription, compulsory military training and so on. And it is kind of interesting that we never had that in Ireland, but actually our establishment is moving us in the direction of militarism, while that idea of compulsory service and conscription is on the wane in most European countries. I mean, most EU countries don't have it. But I think it's ironic when you look at Ireland's neutrality as well, because the establishment in Europe would have said, oh, we were one of a few neutral countries, and Austria and Finland and these countries were neutral as well. But Austria and Finland always had military service, which Ireland never had, which I think is interesting. They're not quite the same neutrality as us. And obviously, Finland now has joined NATO on that. But no, it's a very interesting debate, and we fought stand full square behind those people.
Yeah, I mean, listen, we've been complaining about the increasing militarisation of Europe for a long time. And one of the issues that was raised at the weekend was the this EU rapid deployment capacity that's been set up. And it's this idea of having at least 5,000 troops ready to go to battle at the drop of a hat, and training them in advance, and having a few different units of 5,000. It's scary stuff. And Ireland has already committed 120 troops to it. So the Irish government, even though we're not part of NATO, we're just, it's like as if we're dying to be involved in these military adventures, which, and some of them have links with NATO. And it was very worrying to hear Sinn Féin come out the weekend saying that they wouldn't necessarily shy away from them either, whereas in the past Sinn Féin were very much against these. So that's a worry, I think, for the people of Ireland, that if they're going to go down that tack.
Yeah, I mean, look, it could be that they're strategically weighing up their options. They're talking about not pulling out immediately, but it is a worrying sign, and activists for peace and anti-war activists are going to have to watch that and keep the pressure on, because there's no doubt about it, a Sinn Féin government would be put under huge pressure by both the European Union and by their American backers to continue and escalate a path of militarism, whereas they've consistently said they're not on that page. You can't walk down the middle of the road. They're going to have to make a decision one way or another at some stage. So, yeah,
these units, this rapid deployment setup, It's about actually interfering in skirmishes or wars in other countries outside of the EU. So it's nothing to do with the EU, right? It's a form of foreign interference. I mean, why in God's name would we be sending troops off to interfere in these other countries? It's a bit like an extension of colonialism. And people should remember, if Ireland are going to get involved more with these adventures, people should remember that the Irish Constitution commits us to a peaceful resolution of disputes, not military intervention. And that's something to keep in mind.
And I think your point, Mick, about what's fueling this. I mean, it's very true. Military expenditure in Europe, it has just had its steepest year-on-year increase in 30 years. And if you look at the trend, and the European Network Against the Arms Trade brought out a very good report in recent days about the amount of money on arms. That's what's fueling all of this, because what started in 2017 as a sort of a defence research work allocated 90 million, which is a lot of money, 90 million in terms of defence expenditure. 2 years later, that pot had gone up to $500 million, 500 million. And the period 21 to 27, we're looking at 8 billion euros going into defence, not to mind all the money coming out of the misnamed
pieces. Straight out of the EU budget.
Straight out of the EU budget. And I think which was very interesting was where some of those weapons are going.
Yeah.
And who we're fueling is interested to explore that, because it's contained in that report a total lack of transparency of where it's going. So that destination countries of where the arms are going is to the likes of Israel, Nigeria, Pakistan, Iraq, Qatar, Egypt, Turkey. And these then are going into armed conflicts in Israel, Palestine, in Pakistan, India, around Kashmir, in Libya, in Turkey, Azerbaijan, Syria, all of these places that the EU is feeding into.
Yeah, we can't find enough money to solve the housing crisis and to help people get operations instead of waiting over a year for them. And yet here we are now feeding a military industrial complex. And it's funny, but I only discovered recently that the term military industrial complex, the first guy to use it was a US president, Eisenhower, in 1960 when he was retiring, right? Mm-hmm. And he was just saying, look at for what it's worth, he was more or less saying, I have a huge concern. And he says, it's about what I would describe, he says, as a military industrial complex. And he says, the state is using taxpayers' money to fund research into arms. And then he says, we use taxpayers' money to buy them. And he says, it's going off the Richter scale.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, we should be very concerned about it, and we should watch where this is leading to. And today, directly, the US is spending $130 billion a year on arms. And they reckon that the total bill for arms spend is more like 1.5 trillion per annum. And I mean, it's not like as if there's no poor people in America.
Mm.
This is a monster, and it's been fed by the politicians who were obviously these different arms manufacturers. They helped the president to get into power, and he helps them back.
Mm. And not only like do they have their own huge environmental footprint, but every dollar or euro spent on this is a dollar or a euro less being spent on climate change, social justice, all those important issues.
And do you think there's any hope in this trend declining at some point, or do you think it's just going to keep going up and up, more money being wasted in arms and horror and people being killed?
Well, one of the points raised at the weekend was that that the EU, it appears as if the EU, which started as an economic union with a great focus on peace, is now becoming a military union. It wants to be a military power. And this is not in the interest of the citizens of Europe. It's in the interest of the moneyed few. It's in the interest of the military industrial complex, the arms manufacturers, NATO. But I mean, this is nothing. There's no benefit whatever for the people of Europe in this.
Yeah, I mean, I think the immediate perspective certainly is that the floodgates have been opened. They have a pet media who are cheerleading their cause. And the direction that the European countries are going in certainly at the moment, is one of escalating military expenditure. And contrary to the slogan that sort of, oh, well, we have to do this to protect ourselves, actually, more militarism begets more militarism. Mm-hmm. So we see Ukraine was destabilized many, many years ago. They're trying to do the same now with Taiwan, ratcheting up conflict. I think in the US they reckon that 1/10 of what's spent on militarism is spent on diplomacy. So that's the direction. Not a single voice organizing or calling for peace, interfering in the Balkans, trying to make them next, destabilizing, Cold War rhetoric. So, I mean, there's certainly, we took great heart from the weekend event that people in loads of countries realise what's going on. They're looking for a way to end it. They maybe don't have the confidence of how that can be done, but they certainly haven't bought into it. But the elites are certainly captured at the moment.
Yeah, it's very concerning, yeah.
Okay, we're going to move on to a different topic now. So yesterday was the anniversary of the Nakba Day. Claire, you published a very interesting video. Maybe you want to tell us a bit more about it and what the response has been like.
Yeah, I mean, this was, I suppose, you know, there was an irony in some ways that on the supposed 75th anniversary of the creation of Israel, we had a big hoo-ha and loads of publicity, but actually the Nakba was when the Palestinians were driven off their home and their land, and that's what we marked yesterday. I had a video gone out which actually TikTok censored. It was blocked. Maybe the Zionists didn't like it. But yeah, the sound went on that. But I think it just goes to show, and I think, Mick, you found, like, when we were even in the States recently, people came up to us about our work on Palestine. So I do think it's a hugely important issue for so many people in Ireland and actually around the world to get justice for the Palestinian people.
Yeah, so it was pretty shocking to listen to von der Leyen speak about it, because she talked about it, this was a wonderful celebration of a wonderful event, but hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were expelled from their homes. And today we have there's over 6 million Palestinian refugees in that region that can't go back to Palestine, to their homes. And so it was a terrible crime what happened to the Palestinians. And we have the EU Commission President talking about this as if this was one of the great events of the last 100 years, when in actual fact it was an absolutely criminal event.
Mm. And they kind of have this sort of illusion that there was no one there, mm-hmm. that it was sort of an abandoned land, and that Jewish settlers came and transformed. Completely untrue. People living there, as Mick says, driven out of their homes, and that violence has continued since. So when Ursula von der Leyen celebrated it as a democratic history, I mean, that was just absolutely laughable, because it is now the only country in the world that has got the, I suppose, reached the threshold of being deemed an apartheid state now because of the systemic violation of rights of Palestinian people. So not a whole lot to celebrate there now, for sure.
And we've no problem with participating in the Eurovision Song Contest.
Exactly.
An apartheid state.
Exactly. And Ireland even gave them a good few votes as well. Not to mind that. And a load of their arms and loads of EU money goes in as well, which is quite shocking. We've tried, we've tabled for, there's a mini plenary in Brussels here in 2 weeks' time, and we've asked for a debate on Israel. Not going to happen, I'd say, but anyway, at least we will try yet again. But there's no appetite for that here, unfortunately, you know.
Is there any other MEPs, do you feel, that also support the Palestinian cause, or do you feel like it's something that's very looked down upon? It's hard to even mention in plenaries. How do you think people react when you talk about it?
I know there is MEPs who are pretty strong in their support of the Palestinian cause, but not in the big right-wing groups. They don't go to that space. And I suppose one of the more shocking things is that the German MEPs in particular, mm-hmm. are terrible on it. And it's obviously linked to their own guilt for how they treated Jews during the war. And but now they're happy to watch the Israeli Defence Forces treat the Palestinians abysmally. I mean, it's just, it actually doesn't make any sense, their approach.
Mm, there'd be a few, but generally it's overwhelmingly pro-Israel, more so. Like, Ireland is the only country where across the political groups there's broad support for Palestine. Other than that, as Mick says, all the right-wing groups are rabid Zionists in the main. All the Germans are as well. Countries like Belgium and Malta and that are actually okay on Palestine. Maybe the next nearest ones.
When Israel was attacking the Gaza Strip last summer, there was 66 Palestinian children killed, and there was 2 Israeli children killed. And President von der Leyen went to the trouble of condemning the death of the 2 Israeli kids and didn't mention the 66 Palestinian kids.
Mm.
Now, I mean, how mad is that? Mm. And in fairness, it should be said, when the council meetings were on that time, the council is where they would say the foreign affairs ministers of the 27 countries would have come for a meeting. I would say that without any doubt, Simon Coveney was actually probably the best of them. And while he wouldn't be doing as much as we'd like him to do on the issue, he was better than the rest of them. Fair play to him.
Mm.
Okay, we wanted to comment as well on Belarus. I think you said there was
some interesting feedback from one of our listeners, you know who you are, feeling that our comments about Tikhanovskaya, who was this sort of the exile leader of Belarus, not, but she is the, how would you call her? We refer to her as the Guaido of Belarus, which was the comment that was taken exception to by one of our listeners. I mean, has she received the blessing of the international community as the real leader of Belarus? Not maybe in the same way as Guaido, but pretty much
the likes of Lithuania have tried to be that. Now, she left Belarus after the election and was more or less positioning herself as, oh, I should have won the election. Her husband was in prison, which is obviously totally wrong, and she stood instead of him. But obviously, whether the election result was fair or not, we don't know. Probably wasn't.
Mm.
But the idea that she would have won is nonsense. But the West started to put her up on a pedestal as if she was going to be the new saviour of Belarus. Now, I've had 3 occasions to challenge her at Foreign Affairs Committee, and I found her abysmally weak and incredibly disappointing. I mean, you wouldn't give her a job in a coffee shop. And when she left Belarus and went to Lithuania, the first thing she did was call for sanctions against her own people in Belarus. Now, who would do that?
Mm. That's your usual clue about these people. And I think the point is probably that I think certainly her husband had quite a sizable level of support. Mick says he is in prison. He shouldn't be. There are a lot of political oppositionists in prison in Belarus, including some trade unionists, who I'd like to mention as well. That's completely not on. We don't believe that anybody in any country should be in prison for trying to change their society. But I think Tikhanovskaya herself, if she was put up by that movement as a sort of a place saver or to keep that vote, she's firmly now just a total puppet of the Western establishment now. She's just not with it. And she will be dispensed with accordingly. I mean, there are issues clearly in Belarus, as there are in many other countries as well. Prison conditions there are not good. They're not good in a number of EU member states either, but they're particularly bad there. And there's particularly a lot of oppositionists in prison there. We would be particularly concerned. And I suppose it's an issue that needs to be teased out. Like, there is a legitimate basis for countries to protect themselves against foreign interference and outside attempts to use NGOs and so on at regime change. That does go on. But there's a fine line, because clamping down on your genuine opposition is not on either. And I think it's definitely the case in Belarus that there are trade union leaders who are genuinely the leaders of real independent trade unions, who have tried to organise effective protest action. who have been labelled as sort of receiving foreign money and foreign interference. Absolutely not true. The only money that they ever got was from international workers' solidarity in the best traditions from the days of Marx and Engels and Lenin, workers across national boundaries supporting each other. And these are real leaders who try to organise to improve workers' rights and workers' conditions in Belarus, and they're in prison in difficult circumstances. Now, we've asked to go and visit them. Hopefully that will come off, and we will negotiate. But what we don't do is what the other people do in here. They just immediately scream and roar and, oh my God, sanction Belarus because they're Putin puppets and all this. That's not helpful. That's not helpful. There needs to be negotiation and dialogue, and there needs to be a recognition that countries can protect themselves against foreign interference. But also, we're not afraid of calling it out, and we will absolutely tell the Belarusians, as we will tell everyone else, that it's not on to have people in prison in that. And, you know, we were very glad, for example, to see Bernard Phelan getting out in Iran.
Yeah, that was a great development. And look, as myself and Claire had been dialoguing with the Iranians as much as as was possible over the last while, pleading for him to be released on humanitarian grounds. So it's very good that he's got out, and hopefully relations between Iran and Ireland can improve on the back of this, because Iran does want to have a strong relationship with Ireland, and there's a lot of anti-Iranian sentiment coming from the media in Ireland, which doesn't help matters. And then you have the politicians kind of tone the line rather than risk criticism from the media. But this is really encouraging, and it'd be great now if things can improve from here between Iran and Ireland.
Mm. Well, it's really important to have diplomatic relations with all countries. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're in favour of diplomatic relations with the United States, where there's more people than the whole population of Dublin in pre-trial detention, and they're all generally black and Hispanic people in the US. But we don't say cut off all relations with them, and some of them are in dire prison conditions, as they are in Belarus, and it's not acceptable anywhere. It's not acceptable that protesters in France are in prison either. So we don't make light of these. I would say the prisons in Belarus are even worse than they are in France. I think they are. I don't think I'd be voting for Lukashenko or any of them if I was there either. But that doesn't mean that it's up to us to go in and organise regime change either. But we help and support ordinary people in those countries to do that for themselves and take ownership of that rather than be exploited by others. And it's I think that's an important message as well.
We've been seeing Sudan a lot on the news recently. I think, Mick, you wanted to touch upon that.
Yeah, we mentioned it last week, right? But it's a bit of a horror scene. Mm-hmm. And I think things are going to get worse there before they get better. What you have is you have the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces who were working together, kind of, but they were separate entities, but they've turned on each other. And then there's other militias, especially down in the Darfur region, that have started their own in battles. And there's already there's hundreds of thousands displaced. And I'd be very worried that things will get worse. And the EU is giving out now about these groups. But in actual fact, if people look at what went on over the last couple of years, back in when the war in 2015, when the war in Yemen started, both of these groups supplied armed forces to the Saudi-led coalition, which was supported by the Americans and the Europeans, right? So they were literally implying these people. And the EU implied the RSF in 2017. They were paying them millions for border control to stop migrants moving. Now, how mad? And then we wonder, we're giving out then when these people are causing trouble. But the West is actually very happy to legitimize these groups and the dictatorship that was on in Sudan for the last number of years, because it was in their financial interest to do so. But now that the there's a war starting between them and it's gone a bit mad, oh God, this is terrible. What are we going to do about it? We have to stop the war. But I mean, we've helped to strengthen these militias.
Yeah, I mean, the people there want and deserve a civilian government, but it was interference from abroad that forced them to have the military involved in that governance. And I mean, I think it is an example of how another consequence, I suppose, of flooding Africa with weapons. And it's ironic that the previous African peace facility, which the EU used to have, the EU budgets couldn't be used for armaments expenditure for Africa. But then they changed it to the European peace facility, and that can be used to pay for weapons. And weapons have gone down into that region. The whole area is completely destabilized. And, you know, when you're funding through the back door or through border management, you know, these organisations, well, then don't be surprised then when they start turning on each other. It's but again, the people are completely caught up in it. You can see them lost and frightened, and it's even as if they don't even really have a stake in this fight. They're two kind of warring factions almost over their head. It's a bit like, in a far less violent way so far, but the disputes in Georgia, that the people are completely out of it. You have two kind of ruling groups and the population don't really support any of them, and they're being left behind and used by external forces. So really horrible situation, actually, and very dangerous. Obviously, a lot of Irish people are caught up there in Sudan in it as well. So that kind of brings it home a bit. But what about the people who live there?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much foreign interference in different parts of the world, and it very rarely has a positive outcome. And now we have the Irish government promising to put troops into this rapid deployment force to interfere in affairs outside of the EU. And it just generates more trouble. And it very rarely has a good ending.
Mm. Well, sure, they're running out of ammunition now. They're using so much of it in Ukraine. And the taxpayers' budget, we'll be discussing that again. We mentioned it last week, going into the purchase of shells again to keep the war going, keep the killing going. You literally couldn't make it up.
Yeah, and they're saying they're pulling out all the stops to make sure that there's more ammunition for Ukraine. And as we said last week, imagine if we could pull out all the stops to deal with the housing crisis and the challenges to the health service across Europe.
Or to get everyone around the table and champion peace.
Yeah.
You know, this idea, like, and the media saying that peace is nothing. Peace isn't nothing. Like, the amount of effort that went into the Irish peace agreement, whether you agree with it or not, a huge amount of international diplomacy and years of work went into that. But they can't put any effort into this because they're not ready for it yet in their cosy armchairs.
Oh, it's too bad.
Yeah, desperate.
Right, is there any other topics that you think you'd like to cover?
No, I tell you what, given that, we better wrap up, I think, because people might think the sound is not as good as usual, and you're right, because we couldn't get a studio this week. It's a green week here, and for some reason, I'd say the staff are not on, so we haven't been able to get a studio. And we're just here in our office.
With our great new host.
Don't worry, the regulars are going to be back. I'm just stepping in for now.
All we'll say is she's not related to Manuel, but she is from Barcelona. So we were very delighted to have her with us. So fair play to Maria for joining us today.
Thank you for having
me. So you can do a nice in proper Spanish or Catalan. We could do a goodbye now.
And she looks even better than she sounds.
So do a proper goodbye.
In Gatlan?
Yeah.
Okay. Espero que us hagi agradat el programa i que a partir d'ara cada setmana estigueu amb nosaltres. Us portarem molts temes que són importants i que esperem que molta gent a Catalunya i arreu del món segueixi i que continuï la conversació.
That was lovely. But try and explain one thing to me, right? When the Spaniards speak their own language, how come you speak much faster than you do when you're speaking something else? Because you speak at a pace I don't think that anyone matches.
Well, that was Catalan.
This was Catalan.
I know.
But I think Spanish is supposed to be the fastest language in the world or something like that. I don't know. I'm not sure.
But you spoke real fast there as well in your Catalan.
Yeah. You think I speak faster in Catalan than I do in English?
100%. No contest.
I'm more comfortable in Catalan than
obviously,
I would
yeah.
be in English. So in English, I have to think a little bit. So maybe that's why.
Well, you have a very quick brain then, because you're pretty good at the English.
If I start speaking at that pace in my Wexford accent, no one know what the hell I'm saying.
Anyway, slán a wall, yeah.
Good luck.
Adios.